I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year is 1965. The album, How to Be a Jewish Mother, the artist Gertrude Berg. It's written by Dan Greenberg and David Ross. My guest this week is Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Thank you so much for being here. This is, again, crazy, crazy energy. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you wrote When Women Invented Television.
I did.
Which I found out because friend of the show Rachel Bloom tweeted about it, and I was like, holy crap, I have to read this book. It's a subject matter I'm interested in anyway, but I knew that if she liked it, then it must be something of quality. So before we get into the record itself, let's talk a little bit as to why you dug into these stories, why this was of interest to you, and the stuff you've written in the past that maybe led you down this path.
Absolutely, because this is one where it really does track. I really did stumble on this while doing research for other things. So I write about television history. I write books about television history. I've written 7 now. Wow. And I wrote a book that came out in 2013 called Marion Lou and Rhoda and Ted, mm-hmm. which was about the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And that's really where I first stumbled on parts of this and kind of filed them away and then revisited them in the last few years and decided to write a book about them. But the two big things were that I asked the creators, James L. Brooks and Alan Burns, about the inspirations behind the character Rhoda, who was Mary's best friend mm-hmm. on the show. And one of the many that they mentioned was Gertrude Berg. And, you know, specifically we're talking about Jewishness on television.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Rhoda was a big deal because people weren't Jewish on television in the 1970s. That just mm-hmm. wasn't done. A lot of Jewish people worked in television, but there was still a lot of fear of anti-Semitism. And so it was a big deal that she was openly Jewish. And they mentioned Gertrude, and I was like, I don't know who that is. And they were like, oh, she's a really big deal. And when, of course, I looked her up, I saw that she had been a really big deal. You know, just a few sort of pieces of evidence there. She was voted America's most trusted woman, second only to Eleanor Roosevelt.
So good.
She had a radio show for 17 years before she came over to television. This show was so popular on television, The Goldbergs, that it was the first show to become a movie, and it actually went back onto radio after, you know, being off. And she had a line of house dresses. She had a cookbook. I mean, she had a motherhood advice column. This woman was huge.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, this is crazy that even as a TV nerd, I didn't really know who she was.
Right.
And so that was the first, like, oh, that's strange. And then the other thing was, we talked about Betty White's character on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Sue Ann Nivens. And they said that when they first created the character, they envisioned a Betty White type. And I thought, my gosh, I don't know what that is before Sue Ann Nivens, mm-hmm. because that's what I knew her as. So I was like, what do you mean? And they were like, oh, this kind of sickly sweet, you know, pure, you know, personality on screen. And the joke was going to be that unlike Betty White, she's like, you know, this awful person off screen. And but the Betty White type really stuck with me. And I was like, I don't know what that means. And so I looked this up, and indeed she had this whole almost lifetime of a career first before her second and third and fourth and fifth reinventions. And that is that she was this very sweet talk show host. She had this daytime talk show that she co-hosted in Los Angeles. And in fact, she was on the air 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week, being very sweet.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, which is a whole other thing. But the point is, yes, she had this kind of, she was known as this, and like critics loved or hated her for it, but it was like a super sort of upbeat, perky kind of personality. She wore these flouncy dresses. She was known for her high necklines. And yeah, so she had this whole other life on television. And kind of once I started digging around on those, you know how you go down rabbit holes on the internet, I noticed that women were doing a bunch of things that I kind of didn't really know about, and that they seemed to be doing a lot of things more than I had expected in this time before even Lucille Ball.
Yeah.
So that's when I was like, there's something here, and eventually kind of put it together and decided to write a book about it.
So good. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I live for because, frankly, you know, my brain's not doing the immediate research. My brain isn't immediately spotting the woman missing from the picture, which fucking sucks. And I'm depressed about it. Sometimes in film, I think I notice it because I went to film school. And when you find out that the first person to ever direct a narrative film was a woman, you realize, so I've been given nothing. I've been given no information here. You know?
That's the thing. I mean, and you mentioned film, and the exact same thing happened in film. And the sort of joke I keep making, if you can call it a joke, is that, you know, if you see a bunch of women doing something, it means that either the men haven't gotten there yet or they've already left. And in this case, both TV and film had the thing where, you know, the men hadn't gotten there yet because they were usually busy making money in the parts of the economy that still were booming. So like radio was still the place to make money when TV was starting, and it was still really scrappy and nobody knew what to do. And that's what was so cool about it. Mm-hmm. But it was also like not as lucrative. So the guys were like, I'll just sit back while you all do whatever you want over there in television. And then once it gets built, once it gets big, the men are all like, oh, that looks interesting. And then they kind of rush in around like the mid 50s. And that's when I really date, like the 50s become the 50s, mm-hmm. more like 54, 55. That's when we get the father knows best and stuff like that happening on television.
The thing that's nuts about that, it's exactly that too with film, because and here's the fucking problem, is her name is now escaping me, but she worked for the Lumiere brothers. She made this first narrative film, several narrative films, in fact, had to remake it because it was lost because nobody gave a shit about it. They're off making documentary pictures, which were not, they staged them all. They're basically making reality TV. And she's off being like, I could make high art while you guys are fucking off, like, I guess. So I guess I'll do this. And it's just... yeah, it's exactly that very same thing.
Well, that's wild because, or is it? Because also a huge part of this is that one of the reasons that some of their work is lost is because it's literally lost. So like, it's harder for us to remember and pay tribute to their legacies when we can't stream them or see them at all, especially in this era when we feel like we should be able to access everything. It's funny, but they really didn't think that people were gonna ever rewatch stuff from television at that time. So they didn't archive it very well. At times they were literally like, just tape over that. So
depresses me so much.
Like, right? It's like, so Gertrude Berg's show, The Goldbergs, there is some stuff you can watch, and I highly recommend it. You can even find it online. Mm-hmm. But it's not very good quality, the earliest episodes, which are the best episodes. Mm-hmm. And so they don't look like I Love Lucy, which shot on film, if you want to get film nerd about it.
Yeah.
Gertrude Berg's show is live. And so they only had what was called a kinescope, which is basically a copy of a copy. It looks like somebody, you know, bootlegging in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. And so it's really not very good. So it's never probably going to be on like Netflix, you know?
Right.
And somebody like Hazel Scott, who we haven't talked about yet, but is in my book, the first Black woman to host a primetime national variety show of her own, who was a jazz musician. Her show's literally lost. Like, there's a story that may or may not be true, but I just tell you in the book and tell you it might not be true, but it's okay. So good that the network that she ran on was named Dumont. There was this mm-hmm. fourth network at the time named Dumont. And especially because that network went under, they were bought out. And eventually someone ended up with the tapes that supposedly were literally dumped like off the coast of New York City. Because someone was like, let's make room in the warehouse for something else. So that's the kind of thing where it's just like, so much of this we actually can't see. And that makes it hard for us to fully remember the history because no one cared at the time.
Fuck. Sorry. As a budding archivist, and also as a person who's realized like how much of his own memory has been informed by the lack of that history, it's just like, that's why this book is important. And this kind of research is so important. I'm glad you... We also, like, it's crazy because I know there are probably a million stories you could have chosen from, but you did choose to focus on four women.
Yeah, I did. And it was, you know, I went with the rule of four, which is very clearly, you know, demonstrated over and over in television, right? Golden mm-hmm. Girls, Seinfeld, Sex and the City, if you have about four is like the max, and but you can still get to tell a lot of stories. Mm-hmm. So I really just looked for four women who kind of gave me a diversity of experiences, both as their, you know, the personal life choices they made and what they did in television. So I got a little bit of daytime with like Betty White and Erna Phillips, who created the daytime soap opera. Went kind of more prime time with the Goldbergs, Gertrude Berg, and Hazel Scott's variety show. Hazel Scott was a Black woman. Gertrude was Jewish. Gertrude was doing comedy, you know, so I was trying to get like all these different experiences in there. In addition to also, I really wanted four women who contributed something specific creatively to their genre. So there are other women who did wonderful things,
sure,
but were, you know, acting or something like that. So I really was trying in this case to call my book When Women Invent Television. Mm-hmm. So I wanted them to have invented at least some part of their genre or a certain character archetype, any of those things. I wanted kind of a creative contribution.
And I feel like the outlier in the world of women in TV would be writing. If you were to write about Lucille Ball, it's like writing about the Civil War. Everybody's done it.
That's right. That, and actually my whole idea was almost like she's there, but like this is around her. So it's like my idea was kind of like, you know about Lucille Ball. Here are the women you don't know about who actually even started a little bit before her. Not that much because things were moving fast. You know, she is with us by 1951 in television and just is like, in my opinion, the big bang of television. Period, not just women in television. Mm-hmm. But my idea was kind of like, you think Lucille Ball was this outlier, right? Because that's what I used to think is, sure. Isn't it incredible that the big bang of television is also a woman? Actually, it is incredible, but it's also not, because there were a bunch of women who came in right before her and kind of were already doing this. And then she did it so well. And also, as I mentioned, I think a fascinating side note to this, since you're an archivist, is that a huge reason besides her being a genius is that we remember her is that also her stuff is so well preserved. So they actually decided to shoot on film for that show, mainly because she wanted to be in Los Angeles and most of the operations were in New York.
Okay.
And so New York was where live TV originated, and she and her husband Desi Arnaz were starting a family, and they were like, it'd be more convenient for us to be in LA. Wow. And the network was like, that's fine, but you're gonna have to take a pay cut and you're gonna have to like eat the extra charges of shooting on film.
Okay.
And you're gonna have to figure out how to do it. So they did all of that, and the upshot of that is not only are they the best preserved, but it's the reason that they are massively, you know, their estate is massively rich from the reruns because they owned them. Yeah. That was like the compromise. Okay, fine, whatever. You guys can own it and figure out how to shoot it on film. Go. Mm. And it's just incredible that that quote compromise is the reason, is part of the reason that they are legends. In addition to, I really do think that show is exceptional and kind of elevated what people were doing. You know, they understood the visualness of television and kind of, she was such a physical comedian and just had such a gift that all of that came together to make that a complete legend. But we had to be able to see it, and you can still stream it and it looks great.
Mm-hmm. I got to tell you why, because of the book, I think I knew I could have given you a sentence about who Gertrude Berg was, but I wouldn't even have known her name. I would have known her as Mrs. Goldberg, and that would have been about it. Mm-hmm. And then I was just like, yeah, I know there was another show called The Goldbergs. I know it was in the 50s. I roughly know that. But you talk about this thing in the book. We'll get to the record at some point, but the record's an extension of everything we're talking about, really.
Right.
It is like literally released a year before she passes away,
yes.
And it is right at the end of like her career. She probably doesn't know it. Obviously, it was right at the end of everything for her, but you talk in the book about like what a good ad pitch person she is, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to, I mean, that's why there's this behind me, because I had to put a little bit of something from the show. And I dug it up, and obviously I wanted to make sure it was a Sanka one that I watched. Mm-hmm. And holy shit, are you not wrong? Just her, just like, hey, how are you? She's just like so sweet, welcomes you into her house through her window. She's just talking, and she fumbles a bit, but in no way unprofessionally. She fumbles and keeps going with it. It's so natural talking, and it's just like, and she's, 3 minutes she spends telling you about why you should drink dehydrated decaffeinated coffee. And you're like, oh, what a delightful frigging woman. Where's the rest of the show, please? And thank God there are some on YouTube.
Honestly, I keep trying to explain this to people and you really can't tell unless, so go watch them too. But I am telling you, these ads became my favorite part of the show. I actually enjoy the show. It's not, no knock on the show. But while I was watching several, it was so exciting to me because every ad is different. She was a pioneer in the fact that she said, I want to write my ads myself and deliver them in character. And that was completely new. And I like, it's so innovative. And because her character is her thing. That's what people love. And so she wrote all of her own copy. That fumbly thing she did, that's how she would talk as her character. And her character had a Yiddish accent. And so that's part of it. And she would go for a while. And I was always like in suspense, like, how is she going to turn this one? Right. I was just watching one and it's probably my favorite one where she's like, oh, we just got back from Pincus Pines. And that's the pretend Catskills resort that her family goes to,
which
I love. And so you're thinking like, okay, so how is this going to go? And she's like, everybody's there and they're on vacation, but you know, they're pretty tired. And they're pretty irritable. I'm like, oh, here we go. she's like, you know, I told them Sanka decaffeinated coffee because 97% of the caffeine is removed. But the sleep is left in. And you're just like, ah, oh, she just nailed it again. It's such an art form and I've never seen anything like it before or since.
Well, you know, some of the stuff that I not to make it about me, but I do a lot of writing that is like fake history. And so I'm always digging into old media and my brain, if somebody says, hey, write me an old timey ad, my brain immediately goes to, well, here's blah, 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 and da, blah, 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 just some white guy saying, hello, here's a thing to eat or drink. And I always, first of all, I had no idea she was the pioneer of this stuff. Like, in product placement was like first on her show. And it was just because, oh, we just trust her. Like, she's just like, even the ad guys were like, nah, let's just let her do it herself. That's not a thing. No one does that.
Right. I read the memos and they're so incredible. Good. And not only are they like into it and excited, but they're so like deferential to her. They're like, your copy is beautiful and you're such an artist and we'd never tell you. And I mean, not to be an ad pitch woman myself, but 57%, she increased Sanka sales among her viewers increased by 57%. I don't think you would ever have that kind of statistic today. I mean, and it, like you said, it's just because whatever she was selling, people were buying. And that's just her character. Like, she worked so hard to build up this idea of this Jewish mother character that everyone loved.
If you did that for me, I would drive a dump truck full of diamonds up to your house right? and give you whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, wow, that's remarkable.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not one to normally sit here and celebrate capitalism. I'm doing it specifically for this woman and the fact that nobody knows about it and how pioneering it is. It's fast. And also, again, to artfully move into your show right immediately after that is that you, at some point in the book, you say she was working 18-hour days. Is that, am I remembering correctly?
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. No. These women were just, that's a huge kind of common denominator. I guess that's not a surprise. And I'm sure that's true of anyone in the industry to some extent at that time, but
yeah,
you had to work really hard. And especially when you're the creator, you know, she was the creator. She wrote all the scripts.
Yeah.
She starred in it. You know, it's a live show. So like, you have to remember that they're then having to like pretty much know their lines and do a whole staging. She's also like casting for the next, you know, she's thinking about the next ones and casting them. And, you know, she wrote all the checks herself. She produced it. Like, she was this thing. And you can't overstate how much she was, you know, she was part of this thing from start to finish.
Yeah. And she, again, the way you describe it, good God, I'm sorry. I'm going to mangle it a bit, but just, you open the book basically with her pitching like, hey, basically I deserve this show, which is not wrong. Give me this shot. And you write it. I think you go in a bit into her head where there's this idea of like, she's concerned with the longevity of this and like maybe concerned even, you don't use the word legacy, but I think it's sort of implied in there. Do you, you're talking about people whose legacies you're trying to reignite here. And is that ever something that you're thinking about while you're writing it?
Thinking about their legacies?
Yeah, like reigniting it. Like yeah. That is part of like your, is that part of your, is that a goal you're thinking about as you're writing it, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, that was absolutely, I mean, you know, I like basically pitched this as Hidden Figures for early television. Okay. That's how yep. I explain it when people ask me what my book is about. And yeah, that's, you know, this is something that we've been doing a lot lately. And I'm so glad there's a demand for it in terms of like publishers willing to buy it.
Sure.
And yes, that is like, that's why this was so much fun to write. And it's so much fun for me to promote is because it's, you know, my other books were fun too. And they're about big TV shows. So I've written books about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Seinfeld, Sex and the City. But like, no one's like, oh, so Seinfeld, you say, tell me about this. Why didn't I know more about this television show, Seinfeld? Yeah. You know, like it's, that was really me like, you know, documenting this giant show and its effect. But like, I wasn't informing anyone about the fact that Seinfeld existed. Whereas this is really, this feels like this thing that people really need to know. And it's very exciting for me now because while I was writing it, it almost felt like I was writing fiction. Like, it was hard to talk to other people about it because I'd be like, well, there's Gertrude Berg and Hazel Scott. And they're just kind of like, they don't know what that is. And now to have people saying to me, like wanting to talk about Hazel Scott and Gertrude Berg and Betty White's early career and Erna Phillips to me almost feels like, oh, I'm so excited that people finally know these women so I can talk to them about it.
Yeah. I mean, that is a huge part of it. Man, again, the archive thing always keeps me, it's always keeping me in mind of like, what am I doing for somebody's legacy? Is that the most important part of it? Is it just the preservation in case somebody wants it down the line? But there is definitely in underrepresented people historically, it is a genuine piece of importance to like, especially, I think you're doing honor to what they wanted or hoped for their careers. Because who doesn't want to stick around?
Right. Right, right. And, you know, in to some extent, they had wonderful careers. Like there's a bit, you know, there's part of the book is the fact that they were sort of like had this downturn and were erased to some extent, except Betty White, obviously.
Sure.
But I also like to sort of remind myself even like it wasn't all tragic. Like they, you know, Gertrude Berg lived into the 60s, unfortunately didn't live longer than that. But still even had this kind of this revival on Broadway after her show ended. Hazel Scott, you know, had a great time. She moved to Paris. She, you know, had a nice career. But it's also crazy that we don't know their names, that their names are not more widely known. And that's sort of what I hope this will accomplish to some effect. Like, I want them to be, you know, get a little closer to like parody with a Lucille Ball.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the importance is undeniable. It's just I also like, though, that it's a diverse cast to use a, you know, cast is a terrible word for it. But, you know, it is a diverse group of folks.
Right.
I had zero idea in my brain. It's like, no, TV wasn't even allowing black people on the air. It's basically what my brain thinks. So it did blow my mind. And to also find out how much Gertrude Berg fought for the Jewishness of her show to not change her character's last name to Smith or Jones. I was like, what the heck? What?
It's so crazy. And I mentioned Rhoda, but what's sort of interesting about that connection is that like there's not another overtly Jewish main character on television until the 70s. Like after Gertrude Berg, there's this really, really like long chilled effect of that, you know, there's just, I mean, which I would posit could be, it's general anti-Semitism, but I would also say like the blacklist didn't help the situation. Cause you know, it often went after black people and Jewish people. So, you know, kind of keep your Jewishness under wraps if you want to keep working was sort of the feeling. And yeah, she had, but on her show, especially the earlier days in particular, it's like she's having Passover episodes. They, you know, all like it was very, very clear. This was not, you know, they're going to Pincus Pines. They're all of this stuff like that's both cultural Jewishness and religious Jewishness. There was Seder's, you know, they would they had many of those kinds of, they had a big Seder episode. I believe it was Passover, where it was like very, like a big impressive job, like with, you know, more than a dozen people at the dinner, and they had to have all the food and like all of that stuff. So it really, it was, and she got letters from people thanking her for this, and that they came from Jewish people a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But she, I read some incredible letters that were, I mean, fairly honest, I thought, about, you know, people writing and saying, like, they weren't really clear. They wouldn't say, like, I didn't watch because you were Jewish. They'd be like, I didn't, I wasn't sure about this whole Goldberg's thing at first.
No, yeah.
But then, you know, and but it, it's really touching where people are really saying, like, what, when I got to know your family through this show, I fell in love with it, and I realized that I was kind of being a jerk when I didn't want to watch it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't sort of, I, you know, there are actual studies at this point that have proven the effectiveness of television in getting people to accept other cultures, because there's something about letting people into your living room over and over.
For sure.
And, you know, she was doing that from the beginning.
That's so remarkable. You know, it's interesting. Well, this is a total side thing, but it's curious the kind of feedback you get when you're required to pay for a stamp to give the feedback, when it's not just Twitter. I'm not going to shit on Twitter overall, but it is interesting. Like the things you learn when people are willing to pay money to give
that's
you
that's like, feedback. I mean, and write the letter with your hand, you know, like it's, it, it was, I mean, as I will also mention just the archivist thing, this was a really archive heavy book because three of the four women are dead. Yeah. And two of them have, you know, dedicated archives. So Gertrude Berg has an archive at Syracuse. Erna Phillips has an archive in Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin. And Hazel Scott's son still had her archive essentially at his home when I was doing my research, but it is currently being, you know, done up properly for the Library of Congress. Yeah. So, and even with Betty, like, because I wanted contemporaneous stuff and, you know, that's a long time ago already, I was, you know, at the Margaret Herrick Library, the Oscar Library, to do research for her, as well as even there was some Gertrude Berg stuff there. So this was really archive heavy, and that meant going through people's personal letters, which to me was just, there's something so, I mean, it's fun to talk to somebody, but it's almost more personal to go through someone's, you know, personal effects. I know they were culled, like they decided to put that stuff in there, but still to read those, like you said, the actual letters that people wrote with their hand to Gertrude Berg to tell them how much they loved her. And one of my other favorites, just as a side note, is that she had repeated fan letters from Lincoln Schuster, of Simon and Schuster.
Wow.
He was a huge fan, and like he was like stanning Gertrude Berg. Like he was fully like writing her letters saying like, Mrs. Schuster and I have cleared our schedules on Monday nights so we could watch you. You know, he was Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I think it meant he loved, like he wrote her one, I believe it was about the Passover episode. Like we loved seeing that. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it was particularly fun to go through, and she really enjoyed her fan letters. So she had archived her fan letters quite well and had all of these wonderful letters from people. And like you said, that's an extra step for people to really want to tell you how much they love you.
Did you get to, I'm assuming so, are all the scripts archived or no?
I mean, she had a lot of scripts. Okay. I don't know if it's literally all of them. But yes, like I think all of, like any of my women with scripts, they had script archives in addition to, you'd sometimes get, you know, script notes, things like that.
That's the good stuff.
You know, multiple drafts or script notes. Something interesting that I found on Gertrude, which was actually at the Margaret Herrick Library in Los Angeles, was that Paramount has an archive there. And they made a movie. They made a Goldberg's movie, I think 1 or 2 years into its run on television. And so I could see the scripts for that. And that was very, very interesting because, for instance, they originally had a Passover scene that was, it was a climax. The climax was at Passover, and they actually changed it to just like a normal Seder, like a Friday night Seder. They like de-Jewified it. Just like there was a lot, there were clear indications that the studio was very concerned in a way that television had not been so far at like, how will they all understand? You know, like, so there were just these little things that they kind of took it down a notch. And that was the one that was the most noticeable, was changing it to just like, this is just the normal Friday night dinner. It's not a big deal. They still called it a Seder, but they didn't, it wasn't as kind of religious.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's so tone deaf. That is beyond.
It's so fat. Like, it was fascinating to see. There was even, this is so weird in my opinion, but like, and especially by modern terms, but there's a weird change they made is that they added a beginning where an announcer like says, you know, something to the effect of, he explains what the Bronx is essentially. I don't even know how to, he's like, in the United States of America, in a city called New York, there are different boroughs. There's this and there's that. And there's the, you know, there's Brooklyn and there's also the Bronx. And in the Bronx, like there are apartment buildings. Sometimes Jewish people live there. Here they are. Like, it was just a little.
Wow.
It was a little much. But unfortunately, that is another thing I have not been able to find, is that actual movie. So the only reference I have is the script.
Oh, my God.
And it's too bad because it kind of looks good. Like, I wish I could see it because it looks pretty fun. But despite all of these weird additions to the script, it still looked pretty good.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry that we cannot see that either. But, you know, it that was still informative to see that even in like 1951, they were doing that.
What, the TV show went off the air in 56, is that right?
Something like that. Yeah, it has this like kind of long good night where it starts as a hit, giant hit on CBS. It is derailed when her TV husband, Philip Loeb, is blacklisted. And she spends a lot of time trying to not fire him. Sanka, our friends at Sanka, General Foods, asked her to fire him. She had originally said no, spent a lot of precious time. Like, they're at the heights of their popularity and TV is just like coming into its own. I mean, it's very telling, but basically what happens is her show's yanked off the air. It's supposed to come back in the fall and be paired with this hot new show, I Love Lucy. Oh, and instead, I Love Lucy premieres, is a huge hit instantly. Goldbergs is off the air because she's fighting with General Foods, and it kind of loses its momentum. And it comes back like a couple seasons later on a different network, NBC. She eventually has to fire Philip Loeb because they supposedly can't find a sponsor if he's in it, and kind of gives in and says like, I'm employing all these people, I have to do something. And also, I think, doesn't want to give up her life's work, which is this character in this show.
Yeah.
And kind of like, they come back, she has a different husband, they recast the husband, he doesn't work, they recast him again. That guy is not my favorite. The third one, any of the others, Philip Loeb is a dream, and they had perfect chemistry, and I think you can't mess with that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it kind of limps along. It eventually goes to Dumont, the fourth network, and then it eventually goes into syndication, and they move to the suburbs, and they are so far from Passover, I don't even know what to tell you.
Wow.
They just become kind of, it is a fascinating case study, because those episodes, to my eyes, they look better. They're shot on film by then, they're not live. But she's got this different husband, and they are living in the suburbs, and it's like they know they're trying to be Father Knows Best when they aren't.
Yeah.
You know, and she's just trying to fit in, and she's kind of this relic. I mean, I actually read reviews that said, like, essentially, and this is fascinating to me too, because it's not how I think of it now, but they were like, you know, all the hip young moms now, like the way TV moms are now, they're all like young and thin and clearly like Gentile and white. And I could never have thought of Margaret Anderson from Father Knows Best as the hip young mom.
Right.
That's not my vision of that. But right. I was like, oh, that's true. So the way it was hip to be a mom at the time was to be like young, beautiful, super skinny, Gentile white and like with the vacuum cleaner wearing the dress, right? Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. that was the hip thing at the time. And so even though that seems stuffy and conservative to us now, she was sort of pushed out by this wave of like, this is not, you know, no one wants a, you know, she started that show when she was 50. So she's mm-hmm. almost 60. Like no one wants a 60-year-old, you know, Jewish mother who isn't 100 pounds, right. you know?
Yeah.
And it just like, it was, it, there was, that's how it goes. I mean, it's the circle of life. I get it, but it's another thing that kind of bums me out because I think because of her, because her momentum was cut short by that interlude with the Blacklist, I think it was hard for them to ever fully recover. And so it means that instead of ending triumphantly, they kind of like fade out.
Yeah. And honestly, I will say within 5 seconds of that Sanka ad, I had a crush on her. So I don't care what anybody says. That's
oh my God.
She's adorable as hell.
Oh, like I'm so glad you say that because like, it's hard to express. It's just that thing because mm-hmm. she is just unbelievably appealing. When she, I watched some appearances she did on Milton Berle's show.
Uh-huh.
And she would always go in character, by the way. She would always go as Molly Goldberg. And he loved her. They were good friends. And she sucks. Like, she steals that show so much from Milton Berle. And I mean, I think he knows and he doesn't care.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, it was seeing that kind of thing, even with this man who was literally known as Mr. Television. He was a huge star. Mm-hmm. She just, like, anybody she's on screen with, one of my, I'm probably not going to get this quote exactly right, but I believe it was Brooks Atkinson, who was the huge theater critic at the New York Times at the time, when she did Broadway, which she did win a Tony for, this is a little bit after her show ended, mm-hmm. He said something to the effect of, "We are all children when Gertrude Berg is on stage." And any critics, whenever they wrote about her, I'm telling you, even when the show went off the rails, the TV show, and she, and like, it was clear it was not as good as it used to be, they'd be like, it's not, you know, everything's not perfect, but oh my God, Gertrude Berg is a national treasure and we will watch her do literally anything. Like, critics, you can tell in the way that they're writing about her, like, they are powerless in her orbit.
I love that. I love that so much. Because it's often so written. Actually, you know, here's a very good example. A few days ago, I started, for some reason, got a wild hair, and I decided I wanted to research Jack Parr. I don't know why. Thus far, he's actually kind of bored me. It's fine. I'm interested because I have this one record of his that I want to listen to, but I want to know more about him, right? People often don't like that I don't research enough. So I'm like, I'll research more. And like in his book, he does the thing that you see a lot of comics say, which is either you have it or you don't, which to me is like the most white privileged dude opinion in the world, because of course, yeah, well, I made it without trying. Well, please pay attention to why you made it without trying. Whereas we've got a totally, I'm just so glad that we have this. I don't know. She worked so hard also to get there, but also that at some point she was awarded this kind of pass. And I think she deserves it. I think it's illustrated by this record, which again, recorded when she is, am I doing the math right? She's 65. That is not a 65-year-old woman's energy. That is not a 65-year-old anybody's energy. She doesn't sound like it. She's got all her timing intact. Not to say that 65 is old. I apologize. That makes it sound like I'm being ageist. I'm not. Right. I'm just saying there are a lot of 65-year-old comedians who would have slowed down considerably by then. And she hasn't.
She was truly legendary for her work ethic and her dedication to her career. Her grandchildren, who I talked to for the book, all kind of said, and I think this was a family thing that they would say, is they all said she died of overwork. Mm-hmm. And also just that she hated downtime. She had these product extensions that I was talking about, things like her house dress line book. And I think to a large degree, I almost read that as like, she liked that because when the show was sort of off for a bit, like for the summer or whatever, she still had something to do. Like, oh good, now I'll go tour. Like that's what she would do during the summer. She would go tour department stores to promote her house dress line, or she would go on tour for the cookbook or whatever. And that is what she always did. They said she did not like to sit still. She did not like to be alone. And so she, even if she really was at home, she was still surrounded by friends. And most of the time you know, she liked to be working.
I get that. I get that. It's fighting off a lot of things, but I totally get exactly what that is. Oh, it's,
I mean, yeah, there's definitely some pathology you could explore there. Mm-hmm. But especially for a woman at that time to be like that, so sort of unapologetically, I think she was doing a thing with her image. Like, I think she was emphasizing her motherliness to an extreme degree, for instance, in her image. One of my favorite facts about her is that she had this incredibly successful cookbook, the Molly Goldberg Jewish Family Cookbook, when in fact she did not cook. her grandchildren were like, no, she had a cook named Louise, who was a Black woman who made some really good food. But so that's like, I just say that all the time because it's the perfect encapsulation of her personality. Mm-hmm. She had a co-writer on that book, and the co-writer is like credited. She's not even keeping it a secret, but like, it is a little bit of this illusion. Or she has this line of, you know, inexpensive house dresses for her fans when she loved to dress up like to an extreme degree when she was off. She loved a fur, she had hats, she had gloves, you know, all of this. So she was this master of image as well, and knew that she needed to play up this idea of her as the perfect Jewish mother so that people didn't notice that this was just a character she was playing for money and it was her work, you know? Yeah. That is not what she wanted people to focus on. She wanted people to focus on the character and for not notice, not think about how is this made. I mean, her husband typed her scripts for her, but you know, that was not something that, you know, they talked about it occasionally, but it was mostly like, you know, and he helped her run her empire as well. But, you know, she was, I think, a little bit lucky in that regard. There were some other husbands at the time who would not do that.
No, of course not. No, there's also something to be said for the fact that she's doing, well, anybody, any woman doing TV or frankly anything after all the boys come back from World War II, there was this whole, I think, well explored, like, women are all working. You're part of the workforce. Hey, look, here's Rosie the Riveter. The second they get back home, hey, Rosie, go home. You can make some dinner, can't you? And that's immediately to not switch gears, to kind of stay on that, you know, just keep going is impressive because there's pure societal pressure on you not to.
Oh, completely. And this is something like it came up a lot in Betty White's story, for instance, because she was actually married twice before, you know, she was married twice in her 20s. And her second marriage ended in divorce because she was on this daytime talk show that we were talking about, and she started to really take off. And her husband said point blank, like, I didn't think your career was going to take off like this, and I can't have a career woman as a wife. At that time, she was running home after 5.5 hours a day on television. She was like, oh, no, this is going to work out great because the schedule is like, I can still run home and get dinner ready. And like, that was not even like a thought that there was an option. So she would do her chores and walk the dog and, you know, make dinners by the time he came home. And that's just like, and he just, it still fell apart. And she actually said after that she at that time did not plan to get married ever again, because she thought at this point, it's clear that I have to choose between a career and a husband, and I really want this career. So that's what I'm doing. And she was like she could be demure at times in interviews. She would just be like, oh, I want to give my husband all the attention he deserves. So, you know, right now I can't be married was kind of her standard answer. But more privately, she was a little more like, yeah, I'm not getting married because like it can't be both ways. So she actually lived with her parents and loved it because she loved her parents, first of all. But also, I mean, she actually, you know, I seem like she liked hanging out with him all the time. Mm-hmm. And also, like, now she not only doesn't have to run home and make dinner, but like her mom's there. So this is like, it's a perfect arrangement. It's basically like having a husband,
you know,
or having a wife, sure. I guess, is what I'm trying to say. she needed a wife. And so she instead had her parents, and that worked great for her. But at this time, and I think the pressure starts to really mount toward like the mid-50s, that whole other concept that is taking form after the war really starts to stick. Mm-hmm. And that's when it's like, you better look like father knows best. Mm-hmm. Or if your life does not, then you are not doing it right. And that's when that's really taking hold. By, you know, it takes a while for the 50s to become the 50s. And that's what happens.
That's interesting. Because I will say, to get to the record, because I realize there's so much. I honest to God could talk to you about this for hours. But I want to talk about the record, if only because there are moments. So I wrote down jokes that I thought were good. It is, again, we mentioned not written by her, which therefore she's not working with her best material. It's not, they're not bad jokes, but they are, it is literally 45 minutes of Jewish mother jokes. That's all it is.
And exactly the ones you like, it's, they're the classics.
Yeah. And it is a nice, I've always liked a parody of an instructional record. That's a big thing in the 50s and 60s.
Yes.
This is towards the end of that being hip. It might not be hip anymore, but I enjoy it. But like, there are a couple moments where that audience is eating this shit up just because mm-hmm. you can see her performing it. It's nothing to do with the material. You can hear her laugh a couple times. You can hear her flip pages a couple times. You can hear the pages flip. And I'm like, okay, but they still love it.
Oh, she, this is, it actually is a really good example, because even though you can't see her, I think you still get a good sense. And I just was grinning while I was listening to it because of that, because it's her again. Like, just, she has a wonderful voice too. And it's important to remember she started in radio. So I think she brings a considerable amount of skill to this in a way that maybe others wouldn't. She mm-hmm. knows how to be, you know, for an auditory audience. And also is playing to a live audience that we can hear. And that is a huge part of it. But mm-hmm. yeah, it's funny because so many of these, I would like laugh and then I'd be like, oh, that's such a like cliched joke. Oh, like yeah. None of them were like, oh, isn't that an interesting insight into Jewish motherhood?
Right. Right. No, yeah, it's all the stuff you would expect. But there's obviously a taste for it. I don't have enough as to, because this was a Broadway show, but the Broadway show, she's not in. She wasn't in How to Be a Jewish Mother. It was a book. Then it was a humor book.
Right.
Then it was a play. But she's not in the play that I can see. So they must have just been like, who's the most well-known Jewish mother? Let's have her do the record. That's all I can think.
Right. Was it a play before this? Before the...
Let's see. The year... Okay, so the book... See, okay, so the book came out in 64 and mm-hmm. was the best-selling book by 65. Oh, that's a lot of copies. And then the book was adapted into a play after this. Okay, so...
What year?
67 through 68 is when it ran. So they must have used this as just like a... This is an addendum to the book. This must have been just like, hey, the book's real popular. Let's make a record. That was not an uncommon thing at the time, so...
Right.
And again, who's the best-known Jewish mother? That means this did not have any human voice attached to it until her. So, I mean, it's kind of perfect.
I mean, she really is the perfect person for this. And if I'm not mistaken, she was adapting it. She was going to be involved in a Broadway adaptation, and she died.
Okay, there we go.
So she had two... This is one of my favorites. Goes with what we've been talking about with her. She had two Broadway adaptations in the works when she died, one of which, the other one, it's not this one, one of which had already sold out when she died.
Wow.
So, like, that just shows you how much she was working until the last second, because she had this whole great second kind of wind on Broadway in particular after the show ended, after the Goldbergs ended. I think she really was not sure if the world wanted her to be anything except Molly Goldberg. She held on tight for so long. Mm-hmm. But I really think this shows that she, if she had lived, she would have continued to have a career, because she went to Broadway and won a Tony. So, you know, she really like had this second life. She had tried another sitcom called Mrs. G Goes to College. Mm-hmm. That is exactly what you think it is. Uh-huh. It's about a character not unlike her other character, who goes to college. And it just didn't quite work. Sure. But, you know, her Broadway thing was really, she was doing great and was sort of like sometimes writing, sometimes adapting, sometimes co-writing, and was clearly still working in the genre of the Jewish mother. But, you know, she had such a hand in actually creating this archetype in America that, you know, anything that had to do with Jewish motherhood, she was it.
I mean, the book has to, I mean, I think I can't speak to the development of Jewish culture or representation at all, but knowing the impact the Goldbergs had on the culture as a whole, there has to be a through line there somewhere in the creation of the book, period. I'm imagining she's the first person they thought of. And it's, I don't know, I'm trying to think, every joke is very goofy. And it's just mostly, there's just one guy saying, and this is what you say when this happens. And then, and her delivery is just basically the same every time, but it's so funny. Oh God, what is it? When you're supposed to ask your son about the girl that he's dating, the girl, is she Jewish? What's the family name? What was it before? It's just like, and again, I'm not even trying to do it justice. It's adorable. I didn't write down the one where it gets like this giant guffaw from the room. I didn't write it down, and I'm angry at myself for it. There's a couple where they just eat it up so hard.
Yeah, I think this thing is, it really is an auditory experience. It's all in her delivery and then the audience reaction. Because like you said, there's something about the way she's able to deliver things. I think you can actually picture her somehow, even though you can't see her. And there's something, her voice is really great. She always had a great voice. That's why she was a hit in radio first. And, you know, why she was so powerful that she could come over to television to be like, give me a television show. She was so good on radio.
Yeah.
But it is really funny. And, you know, it reminds me too that the Goldbergs, in all of its incarnations, you know, there were plenty of people who criticized it for being stereotypical. Mm-hmm. And I can't completely argue with that.
Sure.
Like, I don't have a lot of evidence to point to. I think it was really interesting and wonderful at times, and is surprising as a sitcom. But yeah, I think it's hard to separate it from and her and all of everything she does. Her from the Jewish archetypes in general, it's just like they're so wired together. You have to remember she's also coming up during the time of World War II. Like, she's on the radio. Playing the quintessential Jewish mother during World War II, which is remarkable. So this is where it all begins. And it's hard to know where she ends and stereotypes begin.
It's hard because, you know, and again, it's easy for me to make this argument as well, but it's hard to argue against, especially at a certain period of time, that one of the ways to bring all the dipshits along with you was to give them a little opportunity to laugh at you before they realize they're laughing with you. It's unfortunate. It sucks. It's not a reality I'm happy with, but I feel like that was inevitable. There's a little bit of, oh, he talks funny, I'm going to laugh at that. That there's definitely a part of that. Like, this thing that is new and different that I don't understand. And then slowly but surely they enter your life and you're like, oh, I love this person and I'm writing them a fan letter. And it started out with me being an ignorant dipshit who'd maybe never met a Jewish person in my life before. And it's hard. Right. Like, those stereotypes might be the thing that get the dummies in and teach them a lesson, whether they realize it or not.
Sure. And it's that classic thing that we see with so many comedians too, that like, there's a really big difference between her doing this material and me doing this material, you know, and like a non-Jew doing this material. And you know it's being done with love and with experience. And, you know, her parents were immigrants. So it's like, you know, she's bringing that to all of these jokes and kind of comes from within the culture. And so could say if there was one that she was like, no, I'm not going to do that, right? But this was something that came up repeatedly as a criticism, you know. Even at that time, it was big from the very beginning of the Goldbergs. There were certain critics that were just like, no, do not like this. This is too much. This is too stereotypical. It's making fun of immigrants. It's making fun of, you know, it's like, because her characters would often have like, She loved a malapropism, you know, mm-hmm. as kind of an indicator that English wasn't her first language. She did the Yiddish accent, all of that stuff. So, you know, I do think that it's different for her to be doing it versus someone who isn't a Jewish mother.
Yeah. Well, you also make a solid comparison without having to spend too much time on Amos and Andy. But you do make that solid yes. comparison with them being as popular as they were, including, and I don't know if you mentioned it in the book, but if I remember correctly, they were played by the radio guys on TV, but eventually they get switched out for actual African-Americans. Am I?
No, thank God, I guess. There's an insane part, just as a fun aside.
Please, yeah. When I'm fascinated.
This was like one of those things where I kept like reading it over and over, being like, am I really reading this right? So when they were bringing it over, so it used to be, you know, on radio, it was two white men. Mm-hmm. And then they were producing the show for TV. And it was wildly popular, by the way. It was like the most popular radio show. That's why they couldn't resist bringing it to television. Mm-hmm. For a minute, they were considering casting black men mm-hmm. who would lip sync to the white men's voices who used to voice them on radio pretending to be black men.
Wow. That I had not heard. Holy shit.
And I want to write a book that's like bad ideas that thank God didn't happen. Uh-huh. And this is definitely like number one, because I just kept going like, wait, what? Wow. Like I'm reading this in old Variety magazine, like Variety and stuff was Variety and Billboard were actually like just as vibrant then as they are now in terms of their coverage. Uh-huh. And so they were great sources for me. And like, I'm like, you're going to do what now? Wow. Yeah. So they actually dropped that idea and really didn't cast black men. But it was still something that was like protested before it even got on the air because of the radio version. Because mm-hmm. no one, by this time, like people already understood that this was not great, you know, and that it was a very stereotypical show. The NAACP and a million other organizations were like protesting it from the beginning on television. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have read numerous reputable accounts that to some extent, black audiences really liked it. And it's simply because some representation is better than none. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but there was this idea of the quote ethnic comedy at the time in television. And the Goldbergs was usually thought of in this category. There was like Life with Luigi as well, which was mm-hmm. about an Italian immigrant family. And it was very often compared to that show because both were about immigrant families and kind of, you know, loosely the fact that like the children in the family, the next generation were sort of assimilating. And what is that like when you have immigrant parents and sort of assimilated children?
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, her children on TV were so assimilated. They were both played by Gentiles. So
That's right.
I mean, and we're talking, especially her son, mm-hmm. if you drew, like, if I asked someone to draw, like just a 50s kid, like mm-hmm. draw me like a 50s teenage boy, this is what you would draw, like mm-hmm. the all-American like blonde kid from an ad somewhere was her son on television.
And her actual son produced the show, right? The TV
show?
Yeah,
Cherney. Okay. Cherney really, that was sort of his way, I think, of being closer to his mother. He also was a professional musician and found that working for his mother was more remunerative. But he, at some point, he joined the show and produced, wrote with her, did whatever she needed essentially on the show, and eventually also co-wrote her autobiography.
Oh, amazing!
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's so good. I could talk to you for a million years about this stuff, but I would like to very quickly tell people towards the end, I always like to have people say, why listen to this album? The thing, and one of the reasons we didn't talk about the album itself for an hour is like we just explained, it's the same joke over and over again. None of them are bad. They are all the same, though, roughly. So, but why give this thing a listen? Let's say, I would say go to your book first, but let's say there's a record to listen to. Why listen to this one as your first entree into who Gertrude Berg was?
I would say, I think it'll give you a really good sense right away of both what she did, who she is, and as we were talking about more than anything, how good she is. Maybe in a way, because it's like not the greatest material. You know it's only up from here in terms of her stuff.
Yeah.
And you'll hear how talented she is and how charismatic she is. And I think you'll be drawn in by that, and you can learn more about her in When Women Invented Television and check out some Goldbergs as well. But it's a really good, like, very quick first entree into her.
Yeah. We can get When Women Invented Television anywhere, I assume.
Yes, where books are sold, feel free to go to your favorite indie bookstore in particular and get one. But it's available wherever you want to buy your books.
And what's your website, your Twitter, anything else you want people to know about?
Website is jenniferkarmstrong.com, and social media handles are all jmkarmstrong.
You were so smart to get them all the same thing. I'm the idiot who has like three or four different ones because I just had I did not have the concept of branding that Gertrude Berg did, which,
that's
come
right.
on, she was a queen of it.
She would nail Instagram today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Come on. I honestly was so incredibly charmed by you just describing how, and I shouldn't be, this is, again, a capitalist thing, but this right here, the fact that there's a magnolia in a Sanka can, and they're like, that's the perfect, that'll just stay there for the rest of the show. That's this perfect, but it's weirdly charming.
It really is. It's such a smart idea, and especially at that time when advertisers ruled everything. Like, you had one advertiser for your show and they got a hand in everything. Like, if they said no to something, you were done. Mm-hmm. And so it's very interesting because advertisers and shows worked so much more closely together. I mean, like I said, this was multiple memos going back and forth directly from General Foods to Gertrude Berg about how these ads were going to look and how much it was going to be a part of the show. So this was how you had to work at the time. And I think it shows, and this is true of all of my women in this book, it shows her business sense and that she was never like, oh, I'm just about the art. I'm above all this. She just like, what do we need to do to make this ad thing work? You want a can on the windowsill? That's what you're going to get. That's going to work great.
So good. Please, everybody, read the book. This album's on, if you have Amazon Music Plus or whatever the hell it is, it's on there. You can stream this record in a couple places. Other than that, buy the vinyl. I always say buy vinyl. It's probably way cheaper anyway. Thank you again for doing the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years.